Good morning, St. Louis, and this is To Your Health. My name is David Moskowitz. I'm a nephrologist and an internal medicine physician. And this show is brought to you by Genomed, www.genomed.com on the web, and 314-983-9933 on your telephone dial. To Your Health is a public health program that illustrates problems and solutions. And today, we are going to talk about several public health issues, starting with the fact that World Kidney Day is in 2 days, on Thursday. Remember that you can listen on your computer at WGNU920AM.com, or you can tune in on your radio at 920 AM, and you're welcome to call in at 448-4325, or from out of town, toll-free 1-877-920-9468. Thursday is World Kidney Day, and it's been designated as the day around the world in which people pay attention to kidney failure as a disease, and try to address possible cures. And what's interesting about World Kidney Day, which has been organized by the International Society of Nephrology, the parent global group of nephrologists like me. The American version, the American Society of Nephrology, is just one of about 150 participating organizations in the ISN. What's interesting about World Kidney Day is that it has so far been resistant to the cure that I published 8 years ago for chronic kidney failure, for 90% of chronic kidney disease, and for the patent that Genomed was issued also about 8 years ago for acute kidney failure. So World Kidney Day turns out to be an event with deaf ears. Let me talk a little bit about our cure for kidney failure, and then we'll talk about barriers to innovation, which affects medicine perhaps more than any other industry. I don't know of any industry that moves as slowly as medicine, except for perhaps classical music, which tends to stay the same for hundreds of years. In about 15 years ago, my lab, which was at the St. Louis VA on North Grand at the time, realized that the ACE gene, that overactivity of ACE, the angiotensin 1 converting enzyme, which all of you are familiar with if you take ACE inhibitors for your blood pressure, that overactivity of ACE was actually behind all forms of kidney failure. It was behind diabetic kidney failure, behind hypertensive kidney failure. It was behind the rarer forms of kidney failure, like focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, which affects children and adults. But again, like all kidney failure, is more prominent in the African-American community than in the Caucasian community, and is sort of intermediate in the Hispanic community. The only disease, the only reason for kidney failure that is not due to overactivity of ACE is autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. And in children, there's a rare form that's called autosomal recessive, And as an adult nephrologist, I've never actually seen a patient with autosomal recessive, but I have seen several patients with autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. What we found 15 years ago was that very high dose, about five times higher than normal, than conventional dose of a hydrophobic ACE inhibitor, in other words, one of the newer, more fat-loving compounds, because molecules can either be fat-loving or water-loving. Fat-loving are essentially the opposite of water-loving. We observed about 15 years ago that high-dose quinapril actually reversed kidney failure in diabetics and hypertensive patients, but didn't do anything to patients with autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, which is about 5% of kidney failure. But PKD is primarily a disease of whites, not so much African Americans. And in fact, we found that ACE, angiotensin 1 converting enzyme, was actually the African American gene. It was the reason why blacks have five times more kidney failure than whites. And so this was very exciting to me. But the VA where I was working at the time did not handle this news well. The VA was a single payer, and although at the time I had been fervently a single payer advocate, like PNHP, the Physicians for National Health Plan, still are, what the VA did was ignore my patient outcomes and tell me to practice like everybody else, and the result was that that my patients, my 1,000 patients, were handed over to other physicians and proceeded to lose their kidney function at the same rapid rate as they had in my hands before this new treatment. And so I lost my enthusiasm for single payer. When they're good, they're very, very good. But when they're bad, they're awful. And I learned something about modern medicine, which is that it's not as good as old-fashioned medicine. In the 1950s, when we were kids, or when I was a kid and the baby boomers were kids, medicine defeated polio in 1954 and had defeated TB in 1950. And even though there were large industries associated with both diseases, polio wards and hospitals, and TB sanitaria in every village, every town, there was no problem at all about rolling up these properties and closing down the wards because the disease had been eradicated. And there was no question that that society was going to move forward and eradicate these diseases. Fast forward to the current times, and even though it's possible to eradicate 90% of kidney failure, which, as I've said, affects African Americans disproportionately, there's been absolutely no word in the mainstream media that it's even possible. And I call this glaring inequality, this glaring difference, this lurch towards corruption and insensitivity to patients of medicine and healthcare, I call it a modern-day Tuskegee. Because here you have a cure, but you're keeping news of the cure from the people who need to know about the cure the most. So I was extremely pleased to go to the Gordon Research Conference on angiotensin 2 weeks ago, and be surrounded by people who love ACE and love angiotensin II, the product of ACE. The Gordon Research Conference is a very prestigious conference that that features essentially the leaders in biomedical research from around the world. And it was lovely to finally be with a group of people who appreciated the fact that the enzyme they were working on in model systems had so much to do with clinical disease in humans. Because everybody loves to know that the project they're working on is actually important. And everybody would like to alleviate suffering. And the I have to say, I've never had such a warm reception as I did at the Gordon Research Conference. The last night, there were some joke gifts, and I was given a game, the Jeopardy game, for asking the most questions. So clearly, we hit it off. I was afraid I might have been obnoxious for asking so many questions, but in fact, people really felt stimulated by somebody from the clinical world being so involved with their research conference. And what came out of the research conference is an aspect of how ACE behaves on the membrane. ACE is an enzyme that like a pencil sharpener, that just clips off the final two amino acids from a 10 amino acid peptide, angiotensin 1, and changes it into an 8 amino acid peptide called angiotensin 2. The angiotensin 2 has all kinds of activities, including blood pressure elevation. It causes constriction of blood vessels. It also causes, in the short run, growth of smooth muscle cells and thickening of arteries and also growth of kidneys and growth of heart muscle, but in the long run, something called apoptosis or cell suicide, where entire organs disappear before your eyes. Heart muscle gets really thin. Kidneys shrink from 14 centimeters, which is about 7 inches, to 8 centimeters, which is about 4 inches. And with that shrinking, so goes your life and your kidney function and heart function. And so it looks like we've nailed the culprit for shrinking our organs, and it would be simple to prevent the shrinkage just by taking an ACE inhibitor, taking the right ACE inhibitor like quinapril at the right dose, which we've established. And the thing about the high dose is that it suggests that the enzyme actually, once it opens, stays open, and there's no explanation for this so far scientifically, and so it creates a whole new hypothesis and something brand new to look for, and it suggests that the enzyme is in a protein complex on the surface membrane, and protein complexes haven't really been described so much on the plasma membrane, but it's exciting to think that one might be there, and it's always fun in science to have a notion and then pursue it, because even if the notion is wrong, it gets you looking at things, and it's when you look that you tend to find. You may not find exactly what you were looking for, but you find something. And finding something is what research is all about. So, recharged from the Gordon Research Conference, I now would like to tell you why the entire world, including St. Louis, continues to go on dialysis despite hand-waving every World Kidney Day about how bad a disease it is, how much it costs society, how much we need research money to solve it, blah, blah, blah. And when there's a cure, and it's been published in a peer-reviewed medical journal. And the barriers to innovation in medicine are as follows. Number one, there are too many scientific journals. I don't think people realize it, but there are at least 70,000 biomedical journals. Everybody's heard of the New England Journal and Lancet and PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and Nature. But those are the few magazines that Reuters cover. Reuters is a wire service for science stories, medical stories. But in fact, there's 70,000 journals. And so Reuters only covers the very tip of the iceberg. And what's ironic is that of the five journals that Reuters covers, PNAS, Science, and Nature are basic science journals that don't have anything clinical in them. And the only two that have any clinical content are the New England Journal, which has about three new articles a week. Generally, they tend to be on the same subject, and the Lancet, which actually has more like 10 new articles a week. So what the public is getting from Reuters and other science reporters is the very tiniest tip of the iceberg in terms of all the research that's being generated and published in the scientific literature. And by far, that's the biggest problem. So newspapers are full instead of what people wore at the Oscars, but they have nothing, no content in terms of the latest cancer research or the latest kidney cure. And that's something that that frankly scientists have no control over. If our discoveries aren't reported in the mainstream media, it's essentially as if they were never discovered. It's as if we're chopping down trees in the forest, but nobody hears us. So the very explosion of scientific journals, which allows us to communicate with each other, is almost a detriment in terms of us communicating with the public. And us communicating with the public is what I'm doing right now with you all. And if the public wants to communicate with science, let me remind you again that the call-in number is 448-4325 and toll-free 877-920-9468. So here's another reason why you don't hear about what the cures are. The mainstream media... In St. Louis, the TV stations, most radio stations except for this one, haven't responded to my requests to publicize our cure for dialysis, and they basically say their defense is that they don't know how to read science, and so they need somebody in the renal community to endorse the paper. And what's ironic is that I've been waiting for somebody in the renal community for 8 years now to come forward and endorse the paper. There are now three more papers like mine showing that high dose ACE inhibitors or angiotensin II receptor blockers, which is another kind of cousin of the drugs that I use, actually work to prevent kidney failure. And sooner or later, there'll be a whole raft of papers. Mine will still be the first. Whether it gets any credit or not is unpredictable at this point. The later people tend to forget the earlier sources conveniently, and you, it's a very political game whether you get prizes or not. But nobody in the renal community has wanted to cut their financial throat. To prevent 90% of dialysis would be to take away 90% of nephrologists' income. Nephrologists currently make about $500,000, but they make it all from dialysis. Seeing patients who have chronic renal failure who are not yet on dialysis is actually a loss leader. And the hope is that you see them in clinic and that they like you and that they remain yours when they go on dialysis. Because once they're on dialysis, they're worth about $10,000 or $15,000 each. So if you have a stable of about 50 dialysis patients, you're bringing in a cool $500,000. So another barrier to medical innovation is skepticism. Scientific skepticism is the lifeblood of science, and we ought to know this in Missouri. We're the show me state. We're essentially the skeptics of the United States. And so imagine a Missouri scientist who's who needs to really be shown before he believes something. But there, one can be skeptical and refuse to believe things that are clear to everybody else in the room. One can remain a skeptic and a good scientist by such an attitude. But that has to be balanced with the attitude of a physician who's got a waiting room full of patients in agony and who is dying himself or herself to find a cure for the awful disease that's filling up their waiting room. And the problem is that physicians are no longer burning for a cure. They've been essentially squeezed out of the cure-finding process. And instead, they've essentially become processors of people, even though they went to extreme lengths to learn everything there is to know about medicine in arduous training and medical school and residency. We're not using their brains, and managed care has essentially got them operating from a cookbook. If you see a diabetic, this is what you do. If you see a heart failure patient, this is what you do. And now there's a thing called pay for performance, which is hard to pronounce and also hard to do if you've got any kind of independence of mind. And the idea is it's the ultimate in the managed care ongoing fight between managed care administration and physician independence. And pay for performance involves checking off a cookbook, and if you don't go down the checklist and do everything that you're supposed to, you get docked 10% in pay. It'd be nice if they actually gave you more money, but in fact, what they do is they dock your salary by some amount that hurts. And since physicians are pre-meds and are used to getting A's, to have your grade get lowered from an A to a B really hurts, and it makes physicians do exactly what managed care says they should do. Well, the problem is that the people who know the disease best are the practicing physicians who see it every day across their desk, who see it every day in the waiting room. It's not the bureaucrats or the administrators in managed care who haven't seen a patient in years. The people who know disease best are the ones who are taking care of it. And they should be given free range to do whatever they can imagine will benefit the patient, not hurt him or her, but actually arrest the disease. And so we need to encourage physicians to use their brains instead of to park them at the door to their managed care practice. Another problem with another barrier to innovation in medicine is that there's no money for clinical research. The National Institute of Health, the NIH, got out of funding clinical research in the 1960s, leaving it to big pharma or research pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and Merck. The problem is that the research pharmaceuticals like Pfizer and Merck no longer exist. There used to be hundreds of others besides Pfizer and Merck. They're gone now. And they've been swallowed up by Pfizer and Merck. And soon Pfizer and Merck will disappear. And the reason is because there's just not enough market for branded agents. The generic market is 70% of all the drugs that are being prescribed now. Managed care makes sure that generic drugs are used preferentially. And soon the big branded drugs like Lipitor will go off patent, and the branded market will shrink even more. And as the branded market shrinks, research pharmaceutical companies disappear. And while that may be great for people who hate the pharmaceutical industry, and again, I used to, but now I realize that the only advances in treatment come from the pharmaceutical industry. But when I was in my 20s, I thought they were evil, just like Al Gore does. When the pharmaceutical industry disappears, we're all going to be in bad shape because there's going to be a vacuum in drug discovery. There won't be any money to pay for it, and so there won't be any research to keep us out of the hospital. In the long run, this satisfies academic medicine very much indeed, because academic medicine makes all its money in the hospital, especially in the intensive care unit and the operating room. And so the irony about our whole system is that all the prestige, all the research is concentrated in the hands of people who benefit the most by the status quo. In other words, academic medical centers, whom we look to for advances in medicine, are actually the beneficiaries of things staying exactly the way they are. And what they've done, not by design necessarily, but certainly the effect is that that the NIH, by getting out of clinical research and by just funding model systems and mechanisms, has essentially frozen clinical medicine. Right now, we're operating at about 1980s level. In other words, nothing in the last 20 years has happened. And it's likely to be like that for the next 20 or 40 years. And so anybody who wants to reform the healthcare system needs to realize that this is a major problem, that costs are going to remain high as long as we do no clinical research. Now, the Democratic bill calls for clinical effectiveness research. But that is too little and too late. Clinical effectiveness research is a few billion here or a few hundred million there, and it's in the hands of a few agencies, and they're going to give it to their friends to do essentially meaningless projects, essentially the same as the AHRQ. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. The AHRQ, when I told them about my method for preventing dialysis in 2004 had absolutely no interest in it. Neither did the CDC program on chronic diseases and chronic disease prevention. You'd think these people would be interested from their names, from the names of their institutions. And I'm still trying to get the National Institute of Health Kidney Disease Institute interested in the data that I've already produced. But that is a long effort and one that's been going on now for over 15 years. So what we need in the United States is kind of an overhaul of healthcare reform. And what the Democrats have proposed is basically trying to get private insurance to act differently. And the president is coming to our fair city tomorrow to talk to a high school in St. Charles about healthcare reform, and then to go to the Renaissance Hotel for a fundraiser. I wish I were in high school, but I'm not, and I certainly haven't been invited to the St. Charles High School event, and I certainly don't have the money to go to the Renaissance Hotel. But this is what I would tell the president if he ever listened to regular people like you and me. I would tell him that he should leave private insurance alone, that he will not get Republican opposition provided that he takes that he leaves private insurance alone. We're all frustrated with private insurance. Nobody in private insurance wanted to prevent dialysis. Dialysis is their major moneymaker. It is for the reinsurance company. It's their number one reinsurance item. Everybody makes money in the private sector on dialysis. So leave private insurance alone, because from my point of view, frankly, they're hopeless. And instead, focus on the private sector. Focus on Medicare, who's single payer for dialysis. Remember, I used to be a fan of single payer before the VA fired me for finding a cure for dialysis. Well, the other single payer that I ran into was Medicare in 2004. I told them how to avoid 90% of their dialysis budget, which is $40 billion a year, 10% of the entire Medicare budget, and they had absolutely no interest. And so the problem with bureaucrats is they don't want to lose their salaries. Same with the nonprofit sector. The National Kidney Foundation and all the other nonprofits that are raising money for kidney research, none of them will breathe a word about my paper, because then they don't get to raise any more money. So, and the reason why I'm telling you this is because you guys in the audience are the ones whose bodies go on dialysis. You're the ones who bring in $100,000 a year for the 3 or 4 years that you remain alive, and then you die. So you guys are the victims of the system. So it's in your interest, actually, for medicine to change. And it could mean saving your own life. It could certainly mean saving the life of relatives or friends. And that's why we're having this discussion this morning. So when you talk to your representatives about this dialysis cure that's being suppressed, you might also want to mention an idea that you've heard of for healthcare reform, which is to ignore the private sector, leave it alone, and to just focus on the public sector, ignore Medicare because they've shown that they're hopeless, and instead add a third element to the mix. And the third element should be the public health service. If the public health service doesn't do its job, then we're in deep trouble. The public health service was chartered by Congress in 1789 to take care of any American who walked through its doors. And so there's nothing new or special about the PHS. It's not like a collective of insurance people pooling their risks and insurance monies, something that's never existed except for the Puget Sound Cooperative, which is actually losing money. So the PHS is as American as apple pie. It's as American as Congress and the presidency itself. Let the PHS take care of the 50 million uninsured, of whom I happen to be one. I always wanted to feel like what it was, you know, what it was like to not have insurance. And it's not so great. On the other hand, it's not so bad. As long as you're not in a car wreck, you're okay. But it, long term, it's no solution. And the real goal in medicine, which is finally realizable thanks to cutting edge science like genomics, the real goal is to stay out of the hospital, not to go into the hospital, which is what we're told in advertisements for Barnes Hospital and the like, and BJC, but to stay out of the hospital. The best health care is the cheapest health care. So if you can prevent disease, you cost essentially nothing. And that's the revolution that medicine is undergoing, even as we speak. 15 years ago, till the next 5 or 10 years when it finally becomes routine, the revolution that we're in is transformation of medicine from a hospital-based enterprise to an outpatient-based enterprise, from a reactive process to a preventive, proactive process, from a kind of a fourth quarter operation to a first quarter operation, and from not knowing what the disease pathway is to knowing the steps in the disease pathway thanks to genomics. And so now I'd like to entertain Kathy's question. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Kathy?
Yes. I can ask the question now?
You can do anything you want.
The reason I call, my sister died from kidney failure. It was a hell of a time for all the whole family until she did. Do you have a natural cure for the kidney failure thing? Because I was thinking, we went to a seminar. Well, we had some seminar notes from Dr. Matthias Roth out of Florida, and he was talking about the natural cure for 6 kinds of cancer had to do with the vast consumptions of green tea and vitamin C. And I know that that works, but I was, you do know that when he presented it to the AMA, they told him it works. And he proved to them that it worked because he brought his whole team from California and Germany over. And they told him it worked, but they weren't going to publish it in their journal, nor were they going to publicize it, because they said it didn't sell. They couldn't make money off of it. So they said, it works, but we can't make money off of that. So they turned him down, and he was very angry about it. So he told us, you know, all of you that can, tell your friends, your families, though there are natural cures for most diseases. But I was wondering, is there a natural one for kidney failure?
So did your sister die of kidney cancer or on dialysis?
She was on dialysis, and it didn't say. And what happened was she went to 3 different clinics. The last one she went to, it had, she got infection from the dialysis place out of those tubings and stuff that she had. It was horrible.
Right. Well, you bring up a number of questions and points. And the first is that dialysis is a living hell.
Yes, it is.
And it's not. People don't realize that. People think, oh, dialysis, no problem. I'll get a kidney. I'll be on the waiting list. I'll live a long and happy life.
Yeah, but when I saw those stents and things they put in my system, I cringed. Because it's horrible to just look at those things. And if you touch them, oh, it's horrible.
Right. No, it's, look, I'm a nephrologist, and that's what I did for a long time. And mm-hmm. And I can't do it anymore. My fiance keeps asking me to, because it's not like I'm making enough money.
No, brother, do it. Because that man that was talking to this guy from Germany, Matthias Rath,
yeah.
He wasn't after making money. He was after helping people. He said that the people that took oaths in America, the Hippocratic oaths in America,
right.
Said that they would do no harm. He said, and he came over because he found in Germany there were those who turned a deaf ear to him concerning the cure that he knew would work. But it's really fascinating. What you're saying is really fascinating because if there's a natural cure for everything, then why are they doing it? The man showed on he had this PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
He showed us in tubes the six different kinds of cancer from the lungs, the liver, the colon, the one around the neck. What do you call them? Thyroid, not thyroid.
Yeah, thyroid.
Yeah, anyway, that one and the lung cancer, stomach cancer, it was six of them that he mentioned. And he showed in the tubes how vitamin C and green tea absolutely absorb those things. He said that our body produces the thing to kill cancer cells, but not enough of them. Because a lot of people don't go out in the sun like they should and you know, eat different things. But what you're saying... I heard you mention amino acids. Do you have a cure for the kidneys in a natural setting? I like natural things, okay?
Right, you're not alone.
I'm trying to stay healthy as long as I can, huh?
You're not alone. It seems like everybody likes natural cures.
Yeah, well, don't you give up on what you're doing.
Well, thanks. My problem is if I knew of natural stuff, I would use it. Because I like non-toxic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens that the drugs that I use are generic. They're cheaper actually than most vegetables.
Okay.
They're a penny a tablet, and they're harmless. I mean, they're safer than aspirin.
Right, and they don't have side effects. That's the best part.
Well, everything has side effects,
right.
And
that's true.
But you know, so 10% of people get a cough, and mm-hmm. and about 1% of people get a bad allergy where their lips swell up on them. But mm-hmm. But as long as you stop the drug right away, it's not life threatening. So it's about as non-toxic as you can get in medicine, but it's extremely effective. And actually, we had to go up to a very high dose to get an effect, and so what I'm afraid of is that the natural stuff, you know, doesn't have enough concentration, and the dose is important, and so I'm in this particular case, I'm not confident that there will ever be a natural product that will do as well.
Well, you're working on the right word. I'm sure you're going to get to it sooner or later. The light's going to go off, you're going to see that there's a way to do it, but. Because this guy gave us, this doctor, I'm sorry, let's call him a guy, this doctor gave us a video and a CD.
Well, I can give you a PowerPoint. Thanks very much, Kathy, for speaking.
Okay, what was the name of the cure that you said was for? Because I was trying to,
well,
trying to write it down.
You can call 983-9933 or go to genomed.com and read more. www.genomed.com.
Okay, what did you say?
983-9933. And I'll be at the other end when you call up.
Okay, 983-8933.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank
keep
you,
on,
Kathy,
keep
for calling.
Keep on the keeping on.
All right.
Next line, right.
Thanks a lot.
You know the next line, right?
Say what?
I said, keep on and keeping on, and you know the next line, right?
No.
You got to make the best of a bad situation.
No, oh, right, right. Thank you.
Have a great day. Bye bye.
Thank you. I think the audience is lucky that I don't know that next line, because otherwise I would have broken into song. Jim, you have a question.
Yeah, I got a question. Is there a cure for diabetes?
Well, interesting you ask. In fact, I think it's possible to delay the onset of diabetes with these ACE inhibitors. And I'm a case in point. I've been here 30 years. And when I was an intern at age 28...
You're a doctor of what?
I'm a doctor of nephrology.
Kidneys.
I'm a kidney guy. But when I was an intern in internal medicine, the Lancet had just come out, you know, for sticking your finger.
Mm-hmm.
And I volunteered to see what it was like in intern's report. And we had just had donuts because we have donuts at every intern's report.
And that spikes up your sugar.
Man, my sugar was 145. And so the attending was an endocrinologist, a specialist in diabetes. And he said, you are in trouble. Because if your sugar goes up that high,
in a short of time,
you're going to be a diabetic soon. So I've been waiting now for 30 years to be a diabetic. And for the last, say, 15 years, I've been taking this high-dose ACE inhibitor stuff, and I'm still not a diabetic. So I think it's possible to prevent diabetes.
Hey, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
I was recently diagnosed last year, July, with diabetes.
Yep.
My sugar was like 500 when I was administered into the hospital.
Right.
But my sugar fluctuates. Because I've been losing weight and I've been cutting back on the things
sugar
that I was doing.
Yeah.
So is that a good sign when the doctor, when I was in the hospital, the doctor told me that it wouldn't be necessary to take the Lantus that they had me on?
Yeah.
But I think my problem is I got a lot of abdominal weight.
Yeah.
You know, pushing against my pancreas.
I think it's possible that if you went on the high-dose ACE inhibitor, that you would have more sensitivity to the insulin that your body still has in it, in your pancreas.
What does that mean, sensitive to the insulin?
Well, you still have some insulin in your pancreas. It's still releasing insulin. But but the abdominal fat, as you mentioned, it makes your body resistant to it. So you have to put out more and more. And actually, you kind of exhausted your pancreas. So one way to become more, that's your pancreas crying out in agony because it can't produce all the insulin that it needs to in the background there. And so one way is to make your body more sensitive to the little bit of insulin that you have. And high-dose ACE inhibition will make your body more sensitive. It's quite likely that you could come down off the insulin and just be treated with pills.
Well, I don't take the insulin as much as I used to when I was diagnosed with it.
Well,
I mean, some days I don't even have to take it, and I check my sugar regularly with the Lancet.
Right.
So you my finger all the time.
Right. So you asked, and I answered.
Now, what was the medicine you just said?
Well, it'd be easier if you just gave me a call.
What is your number?
983-9933.
983-9933?
Right.
And what is your name, sir?
Dave Moskowitz. M-O-S-K-O-W-I-T-Z. All righty.
983-9933?
Yep.
Yeah, I'll hang up and listen to you more.
Okay,
thanks.
Good.
All right.
Well, the lines are clear. We're going to talk about two more items. One is the state budget. We hear from Reverend Morris and Bernie Hayes an hour before this show about the budget every few days. And I'd like to tell you, today's show was a rebroadcast about how much money Missouri would save if it just stopped building prisons. And I say amen to that. But another way they could save a lot of money is from Medicaid. The MoHealthNet program, which is what Missouri Medicaid is called here, they spend about $900 million on hospitals, close to that same amount on nursing homes, and a little less, $637 million, on pharmacy. And they're spending it on 77,000 adults, seniors over the age of 65, poor seniors, because that's what Medicaid covers. And so they're spending about $6,300 per adult. It would be easy, child's play, really, to save 10% on the hospitals, the nursing homes, and the pharmacy. And all they'd have to do is keep people with congestive heart failure or emphysema from bouncing back and forth to the emergency room, and they could save $90 million of the hospital cost. If they used more home health, they could keep people in their homes and away from the nursing homes. The nursing homes cost $70,000 a year. They're just incredible money sinks. And then pharmacies, it would be easy to consolidate meds to these generic ACE inhibitors instead of some of the other blood pressure pills. And the advantage of that is, number one, the generic ACE inhibitors are quite cheap. And number two, they prevent progression of disease. So they prevent heart failure and heart attacks and kidney failure that the other blood pressure pills don't prevent. So if anybody in the legislature wants to ask me to review the state budget, I'd be happy to, for free. The Department of Health and Human Services, or Senior Services, refuses to talk to me. So in that way, they're like the prison department that is just basically telling the legislature to pay our inflated bills. We don't care how stiff the people, but make sure that we're kept in our cups. And so the legislature is going to have to get some courage to confront the state bureaucrats that don't want to even let them see their budget. And then the second issue that I wanted to talk about is 9/11. And it's important to talk about this because of the motto of our state, which is Salus Populi Suprema Lex Esto, let the health of the people be the supreme law. Now, I think you would all agree that wars are a problem for public health. Let's just look at the cost, okay? The more you spend on wars, the less you have for public health. Let's look at the actual result of wars. The more bullets you receive, the deader you tend to be. There have been a million people killed in Iraq, civilians and so forth, insurgents, and 4,000 American soldiers. It's unlikely that there will be as many people killed in Afghanistan, and the ratio won't be so lopsided. There'll be more Americans killed and fewer Afghanis killed just because there aren't that many people in the whole country. But all of this got launched because of 9/11. And there was a problem with 9/11. I don't know if any of you watching the buildings fall had kind of a funny feeling about it. And the funny feeling I had was, this is not right. This is not how buildings are supposed to fall. They're not supposed to fall down on their footprint. They're supposed to, like, topple over. And the other thing wrong with the way they fell is they fell too damn fast. They fell at free fall speed. So if you calculate what it would take to drop a cannonball from the very top of a 110-story building like World Trade Center 1, it would be about 12 or 13 seconds. And that's exactly how fast World Trade Center 1 and 2 fell. So you're telling me that the strongest buildings in the world turned into thin air, and that, unfortunately, violates some laws of chemistry and physics, which is that concrete and steel are a lot stronger than thin air. And if they aren't, then we got to be worried that that the buildings we're in are going to turn into thin air and we're going to fall. So something happened on 9/11. And what happened, obviously, if you look at World Trade Center 7, where it wasn't even hit by a plane, there was minimal fire, and it just suddenly collapsed at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, almost as an afterthought. If you look closely at what happened at the top of the roof, right near the penthouse, it folded in, which is the classic signature of a controlled demolition. So start with World Trade Center 7, and start with a movie called Loose Change, There have been multiple editions, but the final cut is a good place to start. So just Google loose change and get the argument. It's a visual argument. Little jets of powder being ejected, all of this classic signatures of explosives. And if that's the case, then it's obvious who the criminals are. And this is high treason. There are only three companies that can bring down skyscrapers. One is the controlled demolition of Phoenix, Maryland, that brought down a 44-story building, the J.L. Hudson Department Store in Detroit in 98. Remember that World Trade Center 7 is 47 stories. The next one was a 25-story building the Daikon demolition of Tulsa, Oklahoma brought down. And then the third member of the club happens to be Halliburton's KBR division, the Kellogg Brown Root division of Halliburton, which has since gotten sold off. So that's kind of a coincidence. And then the other thing is Norm Mineta's testimony that the plane was coming in on the Pentagon, and somebody came into Cheney in the bunker and kept telling him that the plane was 50 miles out, 40 miles out, 30 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And Norm Mineta assumed that they were shoot-down orders, but they turned out to be don't-shoot orders, and he was surprised. So he's on testimony as saying that Cheney actually was the one giving the orders to let the plane essentially shoot a cruise missile at the Pentagon. So we're talking about using, laws of gravity, laws of chemistry and physics to calibrate what our leaders are telling us. And it's important. If you're going to try to keep yourself off dialysis, if you're going to try to keep your sons out of Afghanistan, it's important to kind of apply science to what's going on in the newspapers and in the mainstream media. And maybe President Obama, when he comes to Missouri tomorrow, since we're a skeptical show me kind of state, maybe he'll get some of our skepticism and realize that he's got some work to do besides going after the private insurers. He's got to bring Bush and Cheney and a very large conspiracy to heal. And that's what our Justice Department should be doing. So thanks very much for listening to me this hour. Thanks for your questions. I look forward to being with you, God hopes, in another month.